You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 16th of January 2019 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Guy Delaunay. Coming up in tonight's episode of the Theresa May Show, the plucky Prime Minister survives a confidence vote, even though it's clear no one has any confidence in her government.
The House has put its confidence in this government. Yeah. I stand ready to work with any member of this House to deliver on Brexit and ensure that this House retains the confidence of the British people. Yeah.
We'll be heading through the looking glass and sifting through the shenanigans at Westminster and beyond. There's another confidence vote this evening, this time in Athens. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras has put his government on the line, but has he miscalculated? And in the wacky world of Washington, there's a new name in the frame for Attorney General. We'll be hearing why William Barr reckons he's Trump-proof. Talking of interesting presidents, what's the answer to Brazil's shocking violent crime rate? More guns, of course, so reckons new President Jair Bolsonaro as he lifts restrictions on packing a pistol. And are Moscow's trolley buses heading for the scrapyard?
I looked over to the driver and he was nearly crying with frustration. Or was it with grief? Perhaps he'd grown attached to the old trolley, I thought, and he knew all too well what was going to happen to it.
We'll hear more in our preview of The Urbanist. Plus, we'll have the newspapers in Asia and a guided tour around the new Monocle Bureau in LA. That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And you are indeed welcome to the Monocle Daily with me, Guy Delaunay. The last time the British Parliament inflicted such a defeat on the executive, Charles I ended up losing his head. But 24 hours on from her own epochal shellacking, Theresa May didn't even lose the confidence vote. She enjoyed a margin in her favour of 19. That's quite a turnaround from Tuesday's yawning gap of 230, which separated the ayes from the nays on the deal to leave the European Union. So the person who seems to be held in contempt by much of her own party is still leading the country. It's tempting to ask, well, they're smoking at Westminster, and there's every indication that reality checked out of the building some months ago. But for the sake of the UK, one has to hope there's some kind of method behind this apparent madness. We'll be hearing from John McTiernan, the political strategist and commentator who was Tony Blair's director of political operations. But first, let's go to one of the most renowned Westminster journalists, Carol Walker, the political analyst and former BBC political correspondent. Welcome back to the Monocle Daily, Carol. Well, the latest we've got is that Theresa May is gearing up to say something outside number 10 Downing Street, but the runes are that it's a government seal on the lectern rather than a blank lectern, therefore we shouldn't get excited about the idea of an election.
That's right, Guy. I think we'd all be quite surprised if she did suddenly call an election tonight, having just survived a no-confidence motion and made it clear that she doesn't want an election at the moment, because she said it would simply add further instability and delay to this fraught Brexit process. But what an extraordinary few days we've got. Yesterday, Theresa May went down to the worst defeat of a government in UK political history. And then today, she appeared at the dispatch box at 12 noon to answer Prime Minister's questions as normal, and it seemed as though she'd somehow managed to overlook what had happened yesterday, and she was still out there defending her deal. She was still out there attacking the Labour Party and insisting that she was going to battle on and try and get a good deal for the country. All the time, she's now got to find a completely new deal, tweaking the one that was so comprehensively defeated is simply no longer on the cards. She's then got to get that approved in the EU and then get legislation through, all in 72 days before the UK leaves the European Union.
This is all very tricky, of course, isn't it, Carol, for people who are outside of the Westminster bubble. I mean, I must admit, I've been following, I don't count myself as being in the Westminster bubble at all, but I have been very excited about all of this, and it's, you can disappear through the looking glass and down the rabbit hole with this. How can we explain to ordinary human beings a swing of 249 votes in the space of 24 hours?
Well, the short answer, Guy, is that all those people in the Conservative Party, Conservative MPs, who literally queued up to vote against the Prime Minister's deal, when it came to voting against the government, they decided to back Theresa May. Why? Because they don't want a general election. They fear losing their own seats in Parliament. And they're very worried indeed about the prospect of a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn, which it would be a severe risk if the country went to the polls now. So they were happy to vote down Theresa May's deal in the hope that they'll get something better. But for now, they don't want to bring down the government.
What about Mrs. May herself? I mean, we're hearing now that she indeed hasn't called a general election, so none of us were expecting that, and she duly hasn't. But Tom Watson, the veteran Labour MP, did an almost Geoffrey Howe-esque speech in Parliament during Prime Minister's questions today, or might have been during the confidence debate itself. But it was a very well-regarded speech by lots of people from lots of people who saw it, and I've got some of the extracts in front of me. And he dissected her personality, said the cruelest truth of all is she doesn't possess the necessary political skills, empathy, ability, and most crucially, the policy to lead this country any longer. We know she's worked hard, but the truth is she's too set in her ways, too aloof to lead. She lacks the imagination and agility to bring the people with her. You could also argue that she's got no shame, Carol, because if you suffered a defeat like that, regardless of what your party wants, what about, you know, where you're left standing? What about your own personal feelings of professional pride, reputation? I mean, this is humiliating for her.
Well, guys, she has defied all the normal rules of politics. Normally, if you are a prime minister who goes down to the worst defeat in UK political history on the main plank of your policy, on the most important issue facing the country, you would simply resign. And I think what is extraordinary is that by calling this confidence motion today, Jeremy Corbyn bizarrely took the pressure off her. And instead of everyone talking about why the Prime Minister hadn't resigned, they were talking about what Jeremy Corbyn was going to try to achieve, whether he'd get a general election, and whether, if as expected, he lost that move to try and force a general election, he would then move towards backing another referendum. Yes, Theresa May is the most extraordinary politician. You're right that she is certainly somebody who does not necessarily have those normal communication skills, a way of getting on with people, a way of chatting to people, winning over people to her own side, which are normally prerequisites for being a successful politician. But what she certainly does have is some resilience. What was extraordinary is that even last night, straight after that shattering defeat, she appeared at the dispatch box as calm and composed as ever, showing none of the human emotions that you might expect any human being to experience if they had just been dealt such a humiliating blow. She's known as the Maybot.
Yes, indeed.
By people who wonder whether, in fact, that she is a robot remotely controlled from Russia. And when you look at the way that she's got through this last couple of days, you do understand where those accusations come from. She's got resilience, yes, but clearly her time now is numbered. She said she's not going to lead the Conservative Party into the next general election. People looked at the winding up speech in that confidence debate this afternoon by Michael Gove, a leading Brexiteer, who was put up by the government to make the concluding arguments for the government. And many people immediately leapt on his humour and his skill, his adeptness, tub something speech, and said, "Oh well, there's the speech of a future leader, perhaps a future prime minister." Well, at the moment, Theresa May's still there.
Well, let me bring in Carol John McTernan, who knows a thing or two about working with prime ministers. And John, when you see what Theresa May has been doing over the past couple of days, are you filled with admiration or disbelief? What's the emotions which are filling you when you look at the Maybot in action?
So I think the most important thing to understand about Theresa May is her dogged determination. Once she takes up a job, she won't stop until she's finished it. So I think of her as the Terminator in Terminator 2. The liquid metal, you could shoot this thing, it will never die, chasing. So she's not going to give up. But she's also unaware. She's unaware of how much authority she lost yesterday. You don't risk, you know, after you're defeated by historic defeat, as she was yesterday, you can't restore your authority by getting a majority because the DUP and your backbenchers don't like Jeremy Corbyn, because the DUP have been given £1.5 billion to support the confidence and supply deal that they've got. The problem for her is confidence and authority are not related. She may have won a confidence vote, but it didn't give her an ounce more of authority. What she has a strategy, which is, she says, her hard Brexit deal is the only thing on the table. The alternative is no deal.
So if you were at her shoulder now, as you were at Tony Blair's shoulder during his premiership, what would you be advising Theresa May to do at the minute?
So I would say to her, your instinct will be to try to find a way to accommodate your backbenchers, the ERG, and your coalition partners, the DUP, which means you move further and further towards a hard Brexit. You do something on the backstop on Northern Ireland. But to try that, you'll never find enough to satisfy them. They'll always have another objection, another reason. What you have to do is reach across the floor, and you and Jeremy Corbyn between you could do a deal. Because think about it, Prime Minister. You, Theresa May, want Brexit, so does Jeremy Corbyn. The two of you have got the votes. He's got more votes than the Labour Party than you've got rebels. So between you, you could do the thing you want to do for the people and he wants to do because he doesn't like the European Union. Save the country by doing a deal with Jeremy Corbyn. And if you have to, Prime Minister, get his votes for Brexit and then give him the general election he wants, because you owe nothing to the Tory party behind you who have been so disloyal.
At the same time, we're talking about Jeremy Corbyn. There are a couple of ways in which one could look at this, that every possibility is being gone through one after the other in a reasonably logical order to eliminate all the possibilities until just about the only thing left seems to be a referendum. That could be one possible analysis of the Labour Party strategy. Another one could be is that they've got entirely the wrong leader on this issue at this particular time. Which is it, do you think?
The Labour Party strategy was last year's strategic ambiguity, and that was right, because while the Tory party, the governing party, are tearing chunks out of each other, why get in the way? Now the question is, can you pivot from ambiguity to leadership? Because when the Prime Minister loses a vote by 230 votes, she is in no position to bargain. She's got nothing to offer. Somebody else has to step in to lead. And the question that if I was advising Jeremy Corbyn, I'd be saying, you don't want a second referendum, Jeremy. That's why we did the composite. That's why we got the strategy. That's why we'd be at this position. Why don't we seize control of a soft Brexit in the customs union, perhaps in the EEA, perhaps Norway Plus? Why don't you lead? Why don't you speak for Parliament on this? Why don't you be the one that she has to come to speak to? Don't let her dictate the terms. I thought this evening when he said, as soon as you take no deal off the table, I'll come and talk to you, was the beginning of him starting to shape a soft Brexit, because this is the choice. The choice is not a referendum or a no deal. There's really two choices. One is no Brexit, and the other is a Brexit that's the least damaging for the country. Jeremy could own that space, least damaging for the country. I personally would be for just saying no Brexit. This deal is too difficult to do, too hard to get this right. Let's just abandon this and let's deal with the public afterwards.
We've actually seen cross-party collaboration, though, on the backbenchers. You've seen people like Yvette Cooper, Hilary Benn, showing a great amount of cooperation with people like Anna Sobry and Dominic Grieve. There's cross-party cooperation there. Is there, in effect, a shadow leadership going on here on both sides of the House?
There's a shadow government of national unity, certainly. There are many, many more people involved in these conversations than you've mentioned or whoever come into the public. There's a lot of people who represent where the centre ground in the Commons are on both sides, the Tory side and the Labour side, talking to each other constantly. It's true, there's no majority in the House of Commons for crashing out of the European Union with no deal. It's not clear there's a majority for anything other than that. But it means you have to face it down in some way, find a process to stop Article 50, to kick it down the road, or to actually step in and say, this isn't going to work. We're not yet there, but I think what you said earlier, running down the options, going through them, can this get through? Will this get through? It seems like a short space between now and March the 29th, but I think we're going to be talking about this almost every day between now and then. Look, it's full employment for commentators, isn't it?
It's about the only prediction I've heard which is credible. Thank you very much indeed, John. That's John McTernan, former advisor to Tony Blair. We also heard from Carol Walker, the esteemed Westminster correspondent. Thanks, both of you, for joining us on The Daily. You're listening to Monocle 24. It is 16 minutes past 10 in the evening here in London, and this is the Monocle Daily, live from Studio One at Midori House. Now, I suppose you could say that Jeff Sessions did well to last as long as he did. He spent the best part of 2 years as US Attorney General before President Donald Trump announced his sacking on Twitter, of course. Mr. Trump has now put forward William Barr as Chief Lawyer of the United States, and Mr. Barr is already insisting that he's his own man. He says he won't be bullied by the president, and doesn't agree with Mr. Trump's depiction of the Mueller inquiry as a witch hunt. Well, let's talk now to Ryan Williams. He's the executive vice president at Targeted Victory. He was also Mitt Romney's campaign spokesman in 2012. Welcome to The Daily, Ryan. What do we know about Mr. Barr? Is he his own man?
Look, William Barr is uniquely qualified for the job of attorney general because he actually had the job before during the administration of George H.W. Bush in the, I believe it was the early 1990s. He obviously served under a very different president than Donald Trump. George H.W. Bush was a much more conventional Republican than Donald Trump is. So he's someone who has qualifications, who's done the job before, who was fairly well respected as attorney general his first go around, and is positioned, I think, better than any other of the potential options that Trump had as attorney general to go in there and have credibility.
It's one thing entirely to serve under the administration of the senior George Bush, who was a recognizable politician in the US system that wasn't trying to move fast and break things, as perhaps is the Donald Trump style. How could he adapt to the style of Mr. Bush, where everything, of Mr. Trump, where everything we hear from that administration is of exasperation, of people having to say to Mr. Trump, no, you can't do that. Mr. Sessions, indeed, was saying that during his tenure as Attorney General. How could Mr. Barr adapt to that?
I don't think he is going to adapt to it. I think he's someone who has done this job before. He's someone who has built a respected career in the law. He doesn't need this job again. He already had it. And I think he's going to go into this job and be the type of attorney general he was the first go around. And if Trump wants to fire him, he's got nothing to lose. He can fire him because he'll go back to his law firm and make a lot of money. So I think I don't think he stands anything to lose, unlike some of the other rather low quality people that Trump has brought into his administration who are trying to, I think, use the position to advance their own careers. Mr. Barr's career is set. He doesn't need this job, and I think he'll execute the job with credibility when he gets in there.
So this is somebody who, in the old-fashioned sense, wants to serve their country.
That's correct. I think he does. I think he's concerned, as he stressed many times during his hearing, about the independence of the Justice Department, a principle that has been eroded under this president, where he has attacked his former Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. He's installed someone right now as acting Attorney General who doesn't really have the qualifications for the job. and is a loyal political appointee. I think he's someone who understands that the Justice Department needs to be independent, and he'll act that way. That being said, I think he does, as he's said, have some disagreements with the scope of the Mueller investigation, as he's written since leaving office. But he respects Bob Mueller, and he said that. He knows Bob Mueller, and he will not fire him. And he said that very clearly in his hearing.
What about the obvious question, I suppose, Ryan, is for people looking at this, you're painting this rather wonderful picture of William Barr, and people will be saying, hang on a second, why would Donald Trump appoint him? I mean, why would Donald Trump put forward somebody who is going to be his own man, who is going to serve honourably in this very important office, who is going to ensure the independence of the judiciary? None of those things are... We've seen signs that Donald Trump doesn't respect any of those issues. So why would he nominate Mr. Barr?
That's a very good question. And I think the answer to that is that Barr had been critical about the scope of the Mueller investigation, its powers to kind of go beyond its original intention. I'm sure someone showed the president that, and I'm sure that made him like William Barr, who he probably didn't know before being president. Additionally, not a lot of people wanted this job. Not a lot of people want any job in the Trump administration. So you're really dealing from a very small pool. And he is by far the most qualified person. He's someone who I guess Trump must have read that op-ed and thought maybe he's with him. And he's likely a slam dunk for confirmation in the United States Senate. And they really can't afford to put up people right now who are going to have tough confirmations, because the Trump administration has so many vacancies. We have an acting attorney general, an acting EPA director who's being confirmed for the position, an acting interior secretary, an acting secretary of defense. There's really not a lot of room for error to put someone in there who may lose their confirmation hearing, because they have so many important cabinet positions that need to be confirmed or filled with new people at this point.
But at the same time, your suspicion is that Mr. Trump has heard one thing about Mr. Barr that he likes, one detail about Mr. Barr that he's likes. He's honed in on that and maybe ignored the big picture, that this is a man who will serve with honor.
I mean, look, Donald Trump manages to sour on everybody at some point. You have a guy like General Mattis, who he really appreciated his military service initially, and then when they didn't see eye to eye, he soured on him and pushed him out. Same thing with Jeff Sessions, who was probably his biggest booster during the campaign. Jeff Sessions does something any attorney general would do in his circumstance, recuses himself from the investigation given his conflicts, and he gets attacked. So I think Trump sees something he likes. He was comfortable with it, but that does not by any means guarantee he'll like what Mr. Barr does in office, or even like him personally within a few weeks or months of being in the job, if we've looked at how this has played out with other cabinet secretaries.
And I bet there's already a sweepstake running on how long he will last. But thank you very much indeed for joining us, Ryan. That was Ryan Williams. You're listening to The Monocle Daily.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24. Now, back in the 13th century, the Cistercian abbot Arno Amalric quipped, "Kill them all, God will know his own," just prior to the massacre at Béziers, which left around 20,000 dead. And I bring this up because the new government in Brazil has a distinctly religious bent. The foreign minister says the country is undergoing a spiritual rebirth, and he's even described the election of President Jair Bolsonaro as divine providence. But there may also be a lot more funerals to keep the country's priests busy after the president eased restrictions on gun ownership. This in a country which already records more than 60,000 violent deaths every year. Well, Anna Jean Kaiser is our reporter in São Paulo. Anna, it does seem absolutely extraordinary that when you've got a country which has this sort of rate of violent deaths, that you would think that lifting restrictions on gun ownership would be a good thing, but apparently he's being cheered for it.
Right. So this is actually a key campaign promise from Bolsonaro that he is doing good on, you know, in the first few weeks of his presidency. He went around rallies and gave many speeches saying that he wanted to arm the law-abiding citizens of Brazil.
It seems extraordinary, though, that these law-abiding citizens of Brazil would want to have guns in their hands. The United States, you've got the Second Amendment and the whole sort of folk memory of why the right to bear arms exists. But what is there in Brazil?
Right. So actually, Brazil has pretty strict gun laws. The change in this law will remove a requirement that says that you need to declare a reason for wanting to have a gun, and the police need to approve that reason. So that takes it out. But it still is a relatively strict gun law. You need to be 25 to get a gun. You need to have no criminal history. You need to provide proof of steady income and residence. And you also need to do a psychological test and gun training. So it still is relatively strict, but this is what Bolsonaro has just called the first step in sort of making good on this promise.
Of course, as a British citizen, that doesn't sound like a particularly strict gun law at all, because basically there is no private ownership of guns here, with certain exceptional circumstances and farmers, of course. But, we're used to having nothing at all. Are people not concerned that if there are more guns around, that it will just increase the violence? Because that's been the logic in every other situation where we've seen the proliferation of guns. It leads to proliferation of gun crime.
Sure, yeah. I think there is a lot of concern in Brazil, especially for people that live in poor areas who are more affected by gun violence. And interestingly enough, there's a recent poll that actually found that 61% of Brazilians think that civilians should not be able to own guns in any circumstance, which was quite a surprising result, given that this was one of the key platforms for the Bolsonaro campaign.
And of course, Mr. Bolsonaro, a former military officer, his foreign minister seems like a raving religious lunatic. And he put the two together. And what are we going to get from this sort of combination? Because Mr. Bolsonaro as well has talked about his religious beliefs too. If you've got people who've got think they've got, they're divinely ordained, which these two appear to, and they want to arm everybody to the teeth, that doesn't sound like a very promising combination.
Right. As you say, the religious influence in the Bolsonaro administration is very strong. You know, he's been a politician for 30 years, and he has made his religious conservatism very clear throughout his entire career. So this is sort of probably the most power that the church has ever had in Brazil and that religious conservatives have ever had. So we can definitely expect that to be a strong influence for the next 4 years.
And there's no contradiction. For those of us who've read the Bible, and let's face it, anybody who's been brought up in a Christian country will have at least some knowledge of the scriptures. I mean, it generally says things like thou shalt not kill and be nice to each other and all those sort of things. You'd have thought that isn't the Pope rather disgruntled about this idea that once you get in, you lift gun restrictions, making violent deaths for his flock more likely?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a big part of religious Brazilians who are bringing that exact point up, that, you know, this is not what the Bible teaches. This is not what Jesus would teach, and he would not approve of this. And there's even a whole Catholic Evangelical Alliance against Bolsonaro, because they're saying exactly what you're saying, that the things that he's preaching are actually, in their interpretation, and not what the Bible says.
Mm. So who is queuing up then to get their gun permits now these restrictions have been eased? Who's top of the queue? Which social classes, which areas? Who's thinking that they're going to benefit the most?
Yeah, this is definitely going to be sort of middle and upper middle class Brazilians who live in large urban areas that are very affected by violence, which is most big cities in Brazil, and also people that live in rural areas.
And they genuinely think that by having guns in their house, they're not likely to be used against them. Have people learned nothing from the experience of other countries, not least the United States?
Well, a lot of Bolsonaro supporters actually look up to the United States, and they look up to Donald Trump and the conservatives and right wing in the United States, and they think that You know, I interviewed somebody the other day in a city where that's been very affected by violence in the Northeast called Fortaleza. And this person said, I feel like I am I'm in the middle of the ocean without a life raft because I don't have a gun. There's a lot of violent crime in Brazil from guns obtained illegally, which then means that a lot of these people think that, well, if, you know, the criminals are so well armed, I need to be able to defend myself against them.
And if you do get shot with your own weapon, then I suppose you'll go to heaven because you were a good person.
I suppose that may be their line of thinking.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Anna. Anna Jean Kaiser, our reporter, joining us from Rio. And here are some of the other stories we're following today. U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is urging Donald Trump to reschedule his State of the Union address. She's citing security concerns. The Secret Service hasn't been paid during the ongoing government shutdown. Democrats believe Mr. Trump may attack them over the dispute during the address at the end of the month. Also in the U.S., Vice President Mike Pence has claimed so-called Islamic State has been defeated. He said the caliphate has crumbled during an address to the heads of U.S. diplomatic missions from around the world. His remarks came hours after American soldiers were killed in a northern Syria bomb attack claimed by IS. Mr. Pence did not mention the attack in his speech. And thousands of protesters have marched in Belgrade on the first anniversary of the assassination of a Kosovo Serb leader. Demonstrators accuse the authorities of protecting the perpetrators of the unsolved killing of Oliver Ivanovic. It was the seventh anti-government protest since December, and it comes on the eve of a visit by Russia's President Vladimir Putin. This is the Monocle Daily. It's just coming up to 32 minutes past the hour here in London. You're listening to The Daily on Monocle 24, and I'm Guy Delaunay. Now, you will have noticed the confidence votes seem to be all the rage, not just here in Britain, but in Greece as well. Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras actually called for the vote there after the resignation of his defence minister. And the big issue in all of this is the long-running dispute over the name of neighbouring Macedonia. The prime ministers of the two countries have agreed to end this decades-long dispute if the former Yugoslav Republic becomes North Macedonia. But there's fierce opposition in Greece, where many people believe the word Macedonia should only be used by the Greek province of that name. Well, Pavlos Kapadis is following the confidence vote in Athens. It's going to be a late one, isn't it, Pavlos?
The vote actually happened. The Tsipras government survived with a majority of one. The government received 151 votes out of 300. But this was not the real hurdle. However, the real hurdle is the vote about the Macedonia deal that will take place next week amid several protests that have been announced. Mm. And of the 151 MPs that actually support the government, three are not supporting the Macedonia deal.
So what's been achieved here? I mean, I think 151, that was the number we were expecting. I saw those numbers days ago. So this has gone very much as expected. What has Alexis Tsipras actually achieved by calling for staging and winning narrowly this confidence vote?
Well, first of all, he had to prove that he actually still had a majority in parliament. The withdrawal of the independent Greeks, the small nationalist party that was supporting him for the past 4 years, made that his majority went from 152 to 145. So the first order of business was to prove that he still was the prime minister of the country and that he had the votes in parliament to do so. So he survived to fight another day, if you will. But again, the larger question is whether he'll get 151 votes for the Macedonia deal. Mm. What has happened is that in order to get 151 votes for the confidence vote, he took MPs of the only other party that supports the deal, which is the centrist party called the Topotami in Greek. But Topotami, now that Tsipras actually took MPs from them in order to remain in power, is not supporting the deal anymore as payback. Hence, as of now, he probably has 148 votes for the Macedonia deal. That may as well change. Alexis Tsipras is known for being a political survivor, but we'll see.
We've seen this before, haven't we, in fact, Pavlos, in Macedonia, when we had the parliamentary vote on the deal last week. They were going through their final constitutional wranglings in Macedonia to confirm that they would rename the country North Macedonia as long as Athens ratified that particular arrangement. And they needed a two-thirds majority there. And we saw their Prime Minister Zoran Zaev twisting all sorts of arms, promising amnesties here and making all sorts of deals elsewhere. Does Tsipras have that up his sleeve in Greece?
He might. There's a huge difference, though, between what happens in over there and what happens in Greece, is that in Greece, the deal is extremely unpopular. Depending on which survey, the deal is between 65 and 75% of Greeks strongly disapproved. Hence making it a less positive thing for any politician to support the vote on Alexis Tsipras. Overall, in Macedonia, changing the name and going forward with this deal is a huge win for it, because the country will eventually be able to enter NATO and perhaps the EU, as Greece has been blocking both NATO membership and EU membership for its neighboring country. So at least Zoran Zaev has something to look up to, something to promise people, the population, that better days are ahead if you're actually go through with the deal. While in Greece, this is extremely negative, according to 70% of the population. Hence, there's not much to motivate politicians to support him. And okay, there is no amnesty to be granted here.
Okay, Pavlos, thank you very much for joining us. That's Pavlos Kapadais in Athens. You're listening to The Monocle Daily with me, Guy Delaunay. Stay tuned. Now, trolleybuses are, of course, one of the finest forms of urban transportation. They swish almost silently around cities, powered by electricity from overhead lines. They're the original zero-emission bus, in fact, and unlike trams, if they break down, they don't snarl up the whole system. You just stick down the pantograph and a bus can go right around the broken down one. I've seen it happen in Belgrade, and it is a beautiful thing. They've been part of the cityscape in Moscow since 1933, and until recently, the Russian capital had the biggest network of trolleybus lines in the world. But now the city government wants to get rid of them, citing traffic concerns and maintenance costs. It's an outrage, and Monocle's Alexei Kolyarov brings us this tall story.
One time I was in a trolleybus in Moscow. It was very old, that trolleybus, slow and ponderous with age, its driver looking exasperated as it tried to make it go faster. Then, on one particularly difficult stretch of road, it just stopped. It could go no further. I looked over to the driver and he was nearly crying with frustration. Or was it with grief? Perhaps he had grown attached to the old trolley, I thought, and he knew all too well what was going to happen to it.
Our government, Moscow city government, would like to introduce new technologies. So mostly they introduce very good things in scope of public transport. What I mean is bus lanes, priority of tramway. But for some unclear reason, in field of electric buses, they introduce electric buses without charging in motion. So they prefer charging on last stops, on terminal stations.
In the past few years, trolleybuses have been slowly disappearing from Moscow's streets. The city government now plans to phase them out completely by 2020, replacing them with electric buses. Unlike trolleybuses, the government says, electric buses don't need to use overhead wires and so are less likely to cause congestion. But for Alexander Morozov from the Moscow-based think tank Infrastructure Economics Center, such arguments are bunk.
Moscow has the largest network of lines that can be used for charging. Even in cities where we haven't such a network of electric power lines, they introduced them from scratch. For example, Prague, according to our calculations, when we have charging at the terminal station, we need to buy for some intense lines with headways of about 2 minutes. We need to buy about 15 additional buses just to charge them at the terminal station. So the reasons why Moscow government strictly removes wires and forces to go to electric buses charging at terminal stations is not clear for us.
Когда мне не вмочь пересилить беду, когда подступает отчаяние, я в синий троллейбус сажусь на ходу в последний случай.
A clean and efficient method of transport, the trolleybus also has a sentimental value for many Muscovites. It was even immortalized in song by the famous poet and singer Bulat Okudzhava.
Последний троллейбус по улице мчи, и верши по бульварам круженье, чтоб всех подобрать.
That's why the City Hall scheme has not been met with universal approval. Dmitry Grishaev is running a social media campaign to save Moscow's trolleybuses.
В чем заключается ситуация с московским троллейбусом? На мой взгляд, просто разгром самой системы. Причины первые – это политические. Это, например, личные...
Dmitry says there are several factors at play here. Firstly, Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin seems to have a personal dislike of trolleybuses. Secondly, trolleybuses create few opportunities for corruption. And thirdly, there's a lack of qualified transport experts at City Hall.
Логистики в департаменте транспорта. И троллейбусы лишились части хлебных маршрутов, их перевели на автобусы и на электробусы.
So now it seems that if they will not change their mind, they will seriously remove all the trolleybus system from Moscow.
Independent expert Alexander Morozov again.
So, like Paris in 1936, that removed completely all the tramway lines, Moscow, the largest trolleybus network in the world, is going to disappear just in several years.
One way to make the Moscow city government reconsider is to stage street protests. But Dmitry Grishaev says, however much they may love their trolleybuses, Muscovites are not ready to risk going to jail to defend them. All they can do is say what I said to that old trolleybus. Thanks for the ride, man. For Monocle in Moscow, I'm Alexei Korolev.
Well, Alexei has put a lump in my throat there. And I have to say, in defence of Belgrade's trolleybuses, they're very fast and swishy, and they've got some brand new ones from Belarus, which are rather good. They sound better than Moscow's, at any rate. You can hear more city stories on Thursday's edition of The Urbanist tomorrow at 1900 London time on Monocle 24. This is The Monocle Daily.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
And welcome back to The Monocle Daily, where... it is precisely 6:44 in Hong Kong and 22:44 here in London. And that means it's time for a check of the Asian front pages. And we're joined today by David Schlesinger. David, I knew that was going to happen. Schlesinger, right?
Either way.
Well, you want to. Anyway, David is wonderful. He's the former editor-in-chief of Reuters and an expert on China. And so quite correctly, David, we are sticking to your field of expertise. And we have in front of us the front page of the China Daily. Now, this is a story I remember we were doing on the Globalist on Monocle about Tit for tat, really, between China and Canada. Canada arrests a Huawei executive. China sentences a Canadian person to death for drug smuggling. Is that equality of arms?
That's what we have. The question is the law, or is the law an instrument of diplomacy? Now, many people in China think that Canada was being arbitrary when it arrested the Huawei CFO, because they said, why arrest a CFO? If you have a problem with the company, sue the company. But that's what Canada did at the request of the United States, waiting to extradite her because of allegations that Huawei was violating Iran's sanctions. So now China has arrested a former diplomat who's being held without charge yet, but he's languishing in prison. And now this man, Robert Schellenberg, who had been first sentenced to 15 years in prison, all of a sudden, now sentenced to death.
Was that his appeal or was it the prosecution's appeal?
He appealed.
That was a bit silly, wasn't it?
Well,
I could have told him not to do that.
Well, actually, ordinarily under Chinese law, if the defendant appeals, the sentence can't be increased.
Really?
But they found a loophole and were able to send it back. And after taking 4 years to decide on a sentence of 15 years in the first instance, they took one day to increase that to death. So it really does raise the question whether the judiciary were thinking about the law or whether they were thinking about instructions from the diplomats.
I do love this photo of a foreign ministry spokesman Hua Chunying on the front of the China Daily, who does look like she is sucking the proverbial lemon, doesn't she?
She's not happy. She's not happy with Canada, not happy with the US.
And she's saying quite testily, we urge the Canadian side to respect China's judicial sovereignty, correct mistakes, and stop making irresponsible remarks. It's the language is not diplomatic.
No, I mean, China took a person who's been accused of smuggling 222 kilograms of drugs. So he's not a poster boy for Canada's goodness, but they are rather making an example of him.
Yes, indeed they are. South China Morning Post, and I must admit, I chuckled a little bit about this when I was reading this one. The US Pentagon report has knock me down with a feather, David. They're warning that China is a strategic rival.
Well, this is interesting, isn't it? China claims that it isn't. China claims that its Belt and Road Initiative of investment around the world that is simply trying to build investment. It's all for economics. The U.S. now, with hawks in power, think that China is a rival. And obviously, with the trade war that we have, with worries about Taiwan, worries about South China Sea, things are heating up.
And you wouldn't have thought we'd need a Pentagon report to tell them that, but we've got it anyway. Meanwhile, China-Africa relations, you say if there's a vacuum, we'll fill it. Why do you say that?
Well, this story from China was about how every year for the last 29 years, the foreign minister's first trip of the year has been to Africa. Mm. Now, just imagine for a second, would you ever see the United States Secretary of State going to Africa 29 times in a row? Like if they go once in 29 years. The British Foreign Secretary, no. But China is taking Africa very seriously, putting an investment, getting natural resources out.
And this is the Global Times emphasizing this. Global Times being very much a mouthpiece of the Chinese government. And the headline is, China-Africa relations continue to develop, supported by investment into the continent. I love the does what it says on the packet style of subheading writing in the Global.
But just if you connect up with the previous story, if the U.S. is worried about China's a strategic rival, well, get in there and compete. But if you're going to ignore a continent like Africa the way the U.S. has, and China goes in, you reap what you sow.
And we're talking about strategic interests for the United States. The Taipei Times is warning Taiwan's GDP growth might fall to 2.2%. Well, if only Britain had that kind of problem. Taiwan is saying, look, you're busy having a little mini trade war, putative trade war with China. This is damaging us.
Absolutely. So this is all about collateral damage. This is about Taiwan, which, of course, used to be one of the Asian tigers. Back in, up until the year 2000, they used to have growth rates of 10%, 8%, 9%. Now they're down to 2.2% and maybe even...
This is maturity, though, isn't it?
Well, it's not a very happy maturity. Taiwan is completely connected with the Chinese economy at the moment, even though there are very strong political issues and diplomatic issues. But without a healthy Chinese economy, Taiwan's economy and the economy of many countries in the region, they're going to suffer.
Now, the People's Daily. I remember I lived in Phnom Penh for many years, David, and we had a lot of Chinese holidays in Phnom Penh because it was a Sino-Khmer city. So I remember the Hungry Ghost Festival, the Mooncake Festival. I don't actually remember the Spring Festival.
Well, the Spring Festival is most important. It's a New Year. It's a Lunar New Year.
Oh, well, there you go. I would have called it the Chinese New Year, you see. So I've followed the lions around the city. But in China, people have got their parents following them around, telling them to get married. Goodness sake. Get
Absolutely.
On with it. Give us grandchildren.
The People's Daily is all about how there's a rise in mental health problems because people are worried about going home without a boyfriend, girlfriend, fiance. Every year we have stories about people renting themselves out as boyfriends for the week or girlfriends for the week just to keep the parents happy. It's a serious issue.
There's a lot of, I suppose you could call them beards, I suppose, knocking around, but not perhaps not in the sense that we've come to know it.
Perhaps not.
And finally, let's go to the Japan Times, because I think it's always worth dropping in on the world of sumo, the extraordinarily graceful sport, considering the size of the competitors in it. And Yokozuna Kisenosato has retired. And this is very significant for Japan because it's very rare to have a Japanese Yokozuna these days, which is the most prestigious rank.
It's the highest rank. There are only three of them. He's one of the three. He's the only Japanese. He's now retiring. That leaves just two Mongolians in the highest rank of Japan's national sport. As you say, not small people. He's 6'2", or 188 centimeters, 177 kilograms, or 390 pounds. That's a lot of man to retire, but it's leaving
He's
leaving a hole, a very sizable hole in Japan's national sport.
And there will be a weeping, wailing, gnashing of teeth, stamping of feet, and a throwing of salt, I believe it is, isn't it?
Absolutely. Because it's part of the Shinto ritual. You've got religion, you've got culture, you've got national pride all wrapped up in one.
So the pressure's on. We need to find the new Japanese Yokozuna. It's obviously not going to be either of us. Thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Daily, David Schlesinger. You are listening to Monocle 24. Well, Monocle opened its new West Coast US base in Culver City, Los Angeles. And the Bureau Radio Hub and retail space can be found at Platform. It's an expansive site that's also home to high-end fashion, design and food outlets from around the world. The real estate company Runyon Group was behind the development, and the vision came from Runyon's founders David Fishbein and Joey Miller. Our America's editor-at-large Ed Stocker pulled them into the Bureau for a natter, and he was terribly keen to ask Joey why Culver City.
So Culver City is a neighborhood that I knew very well from when I was a kid. In fact, my family owned car dealerships, used car dealerships, on the land where Platform is now. And it seems like it should be a straightforward narrative that they retired from the business and gifted the place to me, and we did all this great stuff with it. But it's a little bit more interesting than that, which we can get into in a minute. But Culver City is a place that I was obviously very familiar with growing up. And it was always a place, the New York Times said that it was a place that you drove through to get somewhere else, which I always loved. What happened about 20 years ago is the city itself got very smart about infrastructure, the way it oriented streets, the way that it pedestrianized certain zones. And you started to see things change where restaurants moved in, then art galleries moved in up and down La Cienega and Washington Boulevards. Then the conjunctive points down in the Hayden Tract came in, and Eric Owen Moss started doing some really groundbreaking architecture. And that brought tenants like Ogilvy, like Nike, into the fold. And from there, that sort of added to the base, which was mostly entertainment, Sony and Culver Studios. What we saw in Culver City was not a place that we knew pretty intimately, a small city that could make nimble planning decisions, but also a place in between lots of other places in Los Angeles. You know, 10 minutes from Beverly Hills, 20 minutes from downtown, 20 minutes from Manhattan Beach and the airport. So it was central, it had nice infrastructure, and the beginnings had already started to come in art, in restaurants, in creative companies. So we knew that there was a spark there that we could sort of fan and grow a little bit.
But I guess in a way, we're getting ahead of ourselves, because Runyon predates, I presume, an interest in COVID, David.
From like an early age, I mean, Joey, I'm sure feels the same. We both had like an incredible interest in design and fashion and great food and just the joys of traveling and having that element of discovery when you're going to new cities. And so before we, you know, ever had our own company, we both had kind of this shared, you know, real passion for the idea that a place should feel like the place that it's created and not like a replica of something that exists elsewhere in the world. And I think that when he and I came together and met, you know, prior to even becoming business partners, we had this, you know, shared ethos that, you know, LA was really kind of going through this incredible creative renaissance in all these different categories, and that, you know, it should have a place that mixed commerce and design and food and fashion in a way that was representative of what was happening in Los Angeles. And we both felt that Culver City kind of being at the heart and center of what was happening around here was like the perfect canvas for us to do something more innovative.
So is that where Runyon all started out? Was Culver the first palette, as it were?
Yeah, it actually wasn't quite Culver. It was the idea before anything, which is like David said, that we wanted to create places that were singular, that were of that place. And the overused word is terroir, where it's like, it's that place because of the soil, the way that the farming's done, the weather, whatever it may be that creates the wine. We always loved the idea of traveling to new places because they were singular. We're separately, even before we met, we would go to a city and look around, and even in London, you go on Regent Street or Oxford Street and you look around and you're like, wait a second, this looks just like Fifth Avenue, looks just like a place in Sydney, looks just like a place in Paris, like whatever it is, that's much less interesting. So we set out to create a company that wanted to contribute to creating places that were singular. The first thing that we did was go to work on what's called the tenant representation side, which is finding small companies that we really believed in, like a Blue Bottle Coffee when they only had a couple cafes that were very passionate about what they were doing, and helping them expand in different markets, whether it be San Francisco or Los Angeles, or for a lot of brands in New York, Miami, and all over the United States. And in doing that work, we were able to see what was making great neighborhoods. And, you know, just the evolution of cities and how they changed, whether it was a high end or a mass kind of a place, that it had its own character. And that was the idea of Runyon when we started. And then, so even before we met, the idea was there. And by the time we met, it was 2011 in Los Angeles, and it turned out to be the perfect place to put that vision forward that we had had before of creating singular place.
So David, maybe you can just explain that for listeners who aren't fully familiar, this idea of how Runyon works in the sense that it's real estate, but you're also looking for the tenants as well, this sort of integrated model.
Yeah, so Joey and I have really developed the business around the idea of always being on the cusp globally of innovators and entrepreneurs that are doing stuff in different spaces that we find really exciting. And through Monocle and through great travel magazines and blogs and stuff like that, we're always kind of like just looking for stuff that we find exciting and has a unique perspective. And then going out and cold calling and contacting these little brands and saying, hey, we've created this incredible place in Los Angeles called Platform, and would you ever consider opening a store there or creating a pop-up shop or doing some sort of event or activation? And through that, we've kind of been able to, you know, work with brands that are just starting off, might be 2 months old and have no ability to sign a long-term lease. Or we might be working with a larger brand that wants to do something more interesting and cool because, you know, they have 400 locations and they want to create an event that targets, you know, a different niche audience. So, you know, we're kind of always really just like exploring and trying to bring an edit to the property that is relevant to us and that hopefully speaks to the creative community of Los Angeles.
That was David Fishbein and Joey Miller of Runyon Group speaking to Ed Stocker at Monocle's new Los Angeles bureau and store based at Platform in Culver City. And we do recommend that you head on over. Well, that's it for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. The show is produced by Daniel Bache and Tom Hall. The researchers were Daphne Karnezes and Martha Libri. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. The Globalist is here in 8 hours' time with Tig Enright. And the Monocle Daily is back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Guy Delaunay. Thanks for listening and goodbye.